welcome to the show. We've been trying to get this going for a week now, a few days. And you, I was so lucky to have a patron of the podcast, a listener, suggest you. And you were so kind as to come on. So would you like to, Professor Hanifi, would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your work, your interests, and then we'll get into the recent developments.
Well, sure. I'm a professor of history at James Madison University, where I teach courses on the Middle East and South Asia and organize a small minor in Middle Eastern studies. But the focus of my work is Afghanistan. My early career was organized around a book, my thesis that became a book called Connecting Histories in Afghanistan, that is about colonial commercial activity, kind of colonial political economy of 19th century Afghanistan. After which time I've moved into a number of other areas, including language history, the history of Pashto, the history of mapping and cartography. And a particular, my second book is an edited volume on the colonial figure and first kind of colonial authority on Afghanistan, Mount Stuart Elphinstone. And currently I'm working on an environmental history of Afghanistan. So I've evolved as a scholar.
The system works. This is supposed to be how the system works, right? You do your dissertation and you grow and you publish the dissertation and then you get sick of the dissertation, which turns into a book, and you get sick of the book. And then you decide to do something completely different because you're sick of the previous project. At least this is what it felt like for me. But I never took the book project. It was just too much. I hated my dissertation way too much to make it into a book project.
Well, it sounds like you pulled the escape hatch at the right time and found a wonderful landing. But it's a pleasure to, have this chance to share some thoughts.
So, I mean, I was thinking we could start with the recent developments, but actually, I think it might be more interesting, especially given your research, to understand the extremely long and complicated and intricate story of empire in Afghanistan, right? Because ultimately, we're only talking about Afghanistan right now because yet another empire is making a hasty exit. And empire is a loose word here, but either way, like foreign intervention is a constant story in Afghanistan history. So, as we sort of mentioned we were emailing, maybe you can just kind of take some time and give us a kind of overview, because a lot of people, including myself, I mean, I'm woefully ignorant about Afghanistan. I'm such like a typical Iranian chauvinist. Like I'm always looking west. Like I know way more about Yemen and Lebanon and Syria than I do about Afghanistan, which is such an indictment of me. You know what I mean? Like it's like, come on, these are like Afghans are like our neighbors, you know? And so like, I just feel like, it's, you know, I mean, I've done a few shows in Afghanistan and who cares about me anyways, but like I've tried to kind of come to terms with my own relative ignorance. So maybe this might be a good time to kind of avoid talking about, or at least for the beginning, you know, what everybody else is talking about, and maybe give a kind of overview and take your time and go into as much detail as possible, because it is quite the astounding history.
Well, I appreciate the confession of your perspective, and that's, you know, Afghanistan contends with these surrounding larger entities, in this case Iran or Persia. It makes sense. You're not to blame yourself, Sina. There's a whole knowledge system that produces the sensation you describe, so it's great to have this opportunity to kind of maybe outline the imperial history of Afghanistan. I think the your prefatory comment about precisely what an empire is maybe a place to start. And, I view empires as really complicated in some ways and pretty simple in others. And they involve fundamentally a lot of cultural and social mixing, a lot of military and technological political exchange. Empires require local collaborators, as we, are being reminded of today. Empires themselves, they have a history, they come and go, but they also think of themselves as, you know, kind of on the edge of history, making history, sort of near a historical destiny or or something along those effects. They give history, they bring other areas into history, give them history. And then as we sort of hear again today, take it away, you know, it goes away. So they also have a geography, empires expand. And in the space we call Afghanistan today has been known by many different names by many different empires in its various regional parts. And it's really only the 19th century when the place as we know it as Afghanistan takes shape. And that's kind of a, you know, an artificial hole at the time. But anyway, for me, environmental history gets me thinking outside of the context of nation states and their geography and history. And fundamentally, the space now appears to me as being historically understood through the Hindu Kush mountain range, the Indus River, and the Amu Darya, Oxus River. And those geographic, you know, realities are so, so important in so many different ways. And what we can say in the first instance is that there are minerals in the Hindu Kush that have been traded internationally since, you know, the time of the Indus Valley Civilization in contemporary Egypt. Cleopatra, you know, was a big fan of lapis lazuli that also enters the pyramids. And so Afghanistan has had a lot of connections through commerce and empires, but it really straddles, it's kind of a tri-cultural frontier or, you know, bridge between the Persian world and Persian civilization, as we just noted, but also the Indian civilizational sphere, as well as, you know, Central Asia, Turkic steppe cultures. And Afghanistan really integrates meeting point of those various traditions in various ways. And, you know, the cultural resources of Afghanistan, perhaps this might be familiar, but some people argue Zoroaster was born in what is today northern Afghanistan, south of the Amu Darya River, Balkh, historic Balkh. But, you know, and that, of course, brings the resources of Afghanistan into imperial play elsewhere, which is, I think, maybe what I was alluding to with the lapis vignette there. But typically, most people narrate, and I think it's understandable and helpful to see about the third century BC is when imperial politics involving Alexander the Great, primarily in the space we call Afghanistan, ushers in other imperial connections between the Mauryans in South Asia. And this kind of meeting between Alexander and the, Indian world, Alexander's expansion ends at the Indus River. And, you know, some argue that Alexander may have passed away floating down the Indus near somewhere in Sindh. But this was a fascinating kind of imperial period for the space called Afghanistan. After Alexander's death, the Seleucid Empire and the Mauryan Empire kind of made a deal involving 500 elephants for the Mauryans to control Afghanistan, which leaves a number of wonderful artifacts for us. The cosmopolitan Ashoka the Great, the Mauryan, great Mauryan king, left an inscription in the Greek language and Aramaic that was found in Kandahar and has since disappeared. It's on the international art market. If any American authorities interested in cultural preservation, if they could find our Ashoka rock pillar, that would be a good use of tax dollars in my view. But moving through imperial sort of layers here, Islam enters the scene in, let's just say about 1000 AD, when the empires of the Ghaznavids and Ghurids occupy the space of Afghanistan. And this is a wonderfully meeting of various cultural traditions. And Islam itself has by 1000 AD, has 400 years of a sort of cosmopolitan infrastructure to it. And We have the Ghaznavids and Ghurids being kind of ethnically Turkic, but it's the birth of the Persian language by Ferdowsi in Ghazna, Afghanistan, around the year 1000. That is a real imperial sort of marker for the space of Afghanistan. And this medieval Islamic imperial context brings Islam and the cultural resources of Islam into South Asia. This begins the Islamization of South Asia. And once again, we have a sort of meeting of traditions in many ways here during this medieval period generally. And ultimately, the presence of Islam in this region might reach its kind of pinnacle, perhaps about 500 years later with Babur's passage through the area known as Afghanistan. Babur being the founder of the Mughal Empire in the early 16th century is what Babur is most known for, but he spent and really gained fame and learned his sort of trade as a conqueror and ruler in Kabul that he loved. And we know how much Babur loved Kabul because he left his memoirs, the Babur Nama, that give us essentially just a wonderful environmental historical tour of the rivers and mountains and forests and animals and trees of the region and its climate. And what's important about the Mughal Empire is that it really continues to synthesize Turkish elements, Persian elements, local Indian elements, and it's the birth of Pashto as a written language that occurs during the Mughal era. And Afghanistan is once again the space of it. And the people called Afghans have a prominence in India under the category of Pathans. And so this is where we start to get some complicated identity politics about who Afghans are, where they are, what is this Pashto language, and a lot of the imperial identity politics have an origin in the Mughal context. But it's at the end of the Mughal period, its latter stages, when the Safavid Empire in Iran is terminated by invasions of Afghans from Kandahar that leads to this very brief Afghan Empire in the mid 18th century based in Kandahar with a ruler who engages in sort of identity politics. He changes his name and, you know, retrospectively in the 20th century is sort of Pashtunized. And in fact, the coronation of Ahmad Shah as it's imagined in the 20th century has a visual expression in that famous image of the Taliban sitting at the desk that Ashraf Ghani gave his last stand speech. And a few hours later, the Talibs are at that desk. The picture behind that desk is the coronation, sort of as imagined by Kabuli elites in the 20th century. But the imperial history really continues with the British Empire. Around maybe 1800 is a marker for this date. And the British Empire, of course, brings all sorts of imperial variables to play in the space of Afghanistan. And, you know, capitalism, industrial violence, large scale warfare, or the birth of Orientalism and the Orientalization of Afghans occurs during this period. And this British imperial period is commonly marked by two Anglo-Afghan wars at more or less the beginning and end of the century. And the first war is the legendary one that the British army is massacred on its escape from Kabul. And more importantly, that figure I mentioned earlier, Mount Stuart Elphinstone, had visited the region of Afghanistan. His account of the Kingdom of Kabul is referenced I've heard it referenced, of all things, as the Bible for Afghanistan studies, the first colonial word. And here is where we get the sort of the ethnicization and the politicization of the space, where Pashtuns are seen to be at the cultural core of this Afghan category, and Kabul is seen as the political center of this people. And you know, this has an enduring impact on local understandings of local conditions. And so we have the beginnings of a sort of self-orientalization, adoption of colonial categories by rulers in Kabul. And it's in the second Afghan war of the 19th century that the conclusion of which was not disastrous for the British, but the structure of future global conduct towards Afghanistan takes shape, with a kind of appointed colonially sponsored and supported ruler in Kabul who relies on external resources to maintain power. And it's kind of what I've referred to elsewhere as jumping in scale, where rulers in Kabul are looking outward to external sorts of possibilities rather than inward to any kind of sense of nation building. And
what can I stop you there for a second? Because sure. why do the Brits have such a hard time? Why three wars, major wars in like 70 years?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a very good question. And I think let's unpack this word war. What do we really mean by war? The certainly the third war, the War of Independence, is, you know, really just some skirmishes and one airplane run. It's not really the sort of thing that we think of as war. Each war looks really different, is my point here. And I think it's, if you want the basic response, I would say it's a failure of local knowledge. Empires are now sort of understood as information systems. And the information that is gathered from local informants and collaborators failed, really, the British. They sort of don't anticipate revolts that lead to their demise. They misunderstand what sort of local legitimacy individual, you know, kind of warlords might, and I use that word cautiously, might be predicated upon. And, you know, I think this is also evident in other imperial fringes in places, you know, like Burma or Nepal. We have, you know, a kind of a failure of information more than anything. Topography certainly has something to do with it, and logistics in the case of Afghanistan, there is no doubt. But there are many reasons, I think. And knowledge, you know, empires produce and depend upon old and newly acquired knowledge. And, you know, we can talk about that in the current context with new technologies in play. But and empires, you know, take different forms. The British Empire was a commercial one that gave, you know, ended with World War II more or less. And this is after which we kind of get informal American imperial projections in the form of development projects, really large scale American funded damming projects in the south of Afghanistan, centered around Kandahar in the 1950s and 60s. So the important point would be here that the Americans adopt during this period British colonial forms of understanding Afghanistan, kind of through Kabul, through these, you know, Persianized, apparently Pashtun, but not kind of rurally connected Pashtuns, and this sort of failure of understanding urban-rural relations and relations between different regions of the space kind of continues here. But in the case of the Americans, what's going on in the imperial context is a Soviet empire, and there's a real competition between Soviet and American and other international development actors, you know, Germans and Japanese, Czechoslovakians active in Afghanistan, really in extensive ways. for the Americans, it's a corporate empire because it's the Morrison Knutson Construction Company that got the contracts to build the hydroelectric river dams in the south of Afghanistan on the Helmand River and Arghandab River. While the Soviets were damming rivers and building roads in the north, the Americans were in the south, the sort of divided global development war, imperial war, as it were, in Afghanistan during the Cold War. And, you know, I think in terms of imperial history, it's probably, you know, good to mention the Soviet imperial experience, I guess, in Afghanistan with, I guess, you know, a new form of technological, air warfare. And so mainly it's a helicopter the Soviets had, the Mi-24, 25, the Hind helicopter that was a big part of that war. And the Soviet Empire was really aggressively for female education and literacy and empowerment and having, you know, unveiled women on TV and on the radio. And it's very important to note that though when the Soviet Union leaves, it's largely because of American covert support of the Mujahideen, and this maybe is all the preface to the current era, really. But you know, when the Soviet Empire leaves, it shortly afterwards sort of disintegrates, I guess. And
what's interesting is that, like, the Najibullah government, which was like being propped up by the Soviets, it lasts a pretty long time on its, I mean, supposedly on its own, but I mean, it lost its main backer. The Soviet Union didn't exist in the early 90s. And so it's interesting that, I mean, someone tweeted this. I'm not taking credit for this insight. I saw it online somewhere. They were like, oh, then Najibullah lasted 3 years. Ghani didn't last a week, you know? And it's like, and it's interesting that, I mean, I hate to say this, and I like taking a step back from like listening to this, it's like, do Afghans have like Polish people problems and like Ukrainian people problems? Are you guys just like stuck geographically between, I mean, you said it, and it was not like I'm just asking you to like kind of consider this, like look at it again, but like being not landlocked literally, but like geopolitically landlocked between these massive powers, right? Like existing at this intersection, and like famously, like, you know, who would like Mackinder and stuff, like those guys all love talking about Afghanistan because it's like this intersection, like almost this romantic orientalist like chatter about this place that's like, you know, that's like not Iran, and it's like not South Asia, it's not, you know, like it's like its own entity that's always sort of stood on its own sort of discursively. And I mean, that's probably like a modern invention too of orientalism, I guess.
I think a little bit. And, you know, I guess primarily, maybe it, I don't know if it's an American audience, but the kind of area studies tradition that have marginalized all sorts of boundary frontier areas. Afghanistan's a real victim of area studies in the sense that it never got, you know, kind of firmly incorporated into Middle Eastern studies programs or South Asian studies programs or
that's true. I never thought of that. It falls between the gaps, like because it's again, it's that cultural powerhouse thing stuck between, you know, large languages. And I mean, it's got it's like, you know, I say this a lot on this show. It's like all countries are fake, but some like more than others. Like, and so it's kind of like the fakeness of Afghanistan is an interesting thing to consider, right? Like its own territoriality, but and now, especially considering the meaning of the Taliban in terms of development of like sovereignty or whatever, a kind of nation state, like it's interesting to see this from this perspective that I'm getting from you today of like this territorial integrity that really is subject to all these kind of imperial sort of machinations that just change power over time. And really, I had no idea about the American presence before the 79, but of course they're there, right? I didn't really know about that, but of course they're, so they, I mean, it's true that they inherited that British system that had fallen apart by 1919. And I never thought of the third Afghan war as kind of like just a kind of haste and retreat. And it's true, but like to think of like that inheritance of the British world system that comes into the American hands, but then instantly gets put into the machine, like the sausage machine of like the Cold War. And like, instantly sort of like the power politics with the USSR. And it's, you know, I mean, it's mind bending to think of.
Yeah. Well, you know, your comments speak to what I don't know, the geopolitical international sort of puzzle that Afghanistan represents to the, you know, various powers, Soviets, Americans, Iranians, whatever the case may be. But at the same time, Sina, it's important for us in the audience to embrace that these imperial projections carry a lot of opportunities, and the Afghan political elite, the, you know, kind of political culture that takes shape in Kabul is, you know, organically predicated, tied to those various imperial possibilities. And, you know, the war of 1919, I'm glad you're somewhat familiar with it, because what it is often, it was just celebrated a couple summers ago, it's, you know, 100 years of independence. And that's known, 1919 is sort of understood as when Afghanistan gets its independence, but there's never really a question about independence from what, and it's independence from the British. And there's not a lot of coming to terms with the British impact on the place and space and people before 1919. And what 1919 is very important to note is that it did not end British influence. The British turned actually much more intensively, you know, built the largest embassy in Asia in Kabul during the 1920s, that actually was an airfield for evacuating the British legation from kind of, speaking of airlifts, in 1929 from Kabul, when the modernizing king, the independent Afghan king Amanullah and his Turkish wife Soraya were overthrown. And what that period is so important for is that it not only Afghanistan's independence merely created new forms of dependency on the range of international actors. And so we get French and German in particular influences really, really expanding. And
so do they have the same situation as in other parts of the Levant and Iraq and stuff in terms of the major powers kind of trying to outmaneuver the Germans? Was that, did that happen? And did that reach over to Afghanistan too?
Yeah, well, in both world wars, I guess, you know, because the demise of the, Ottoman Caliphate leads to the proposition of the new independent Afghan Muslim king, independent in quotes, being the sort of heir to the Muslim Ummah. This generates a huge migration of Indian Muslims, you know, in part because of the politics of British India at that time. But there was a real kind of a lot of global attention to Afghanistan during this period by Muslims in throughout the Middle East, but also European powers. And Afghanistan sort of remains, you know, uninvolved, although there are some little missions to get Afghanistan to join the various actors during World War I. And that happens again in World War II. Afghanistan stays technically independent from any of the kind of global alliances of both of these wars. But at that, in so doing, it really opened up Afghanistan to exposure from all of them. And this carries just tremendous consequences, you know, even for how the so-called, you know, Taliban who emerge out of the Afghan Mujahideen are really a global, you know, kind of body, Chechens and Indonesians and, you know, Arabs, you know, in addition to Afghans of many, you know, different subgroups, Pashtuns and non-Pashtuns. And there's a global history of Afghanistan that, you know, kind of we can see through this imperial lens.
Earlier, I made this thing about like the sort of landlocked nature of Afghan politics. And I was like, oh, yeah, not literally. But I realized, of course, it is literally landlocked to the country and bound in by these other countries around it, right? Like geographically bound in literally. So it's like this, once again, like, I don't know, I sound like such an Orientalist doing this, but like, I feel like, is this just like the sad fate that like Afghanistan has been befallen for like centuries now of just being stuck, just being this kind of stuckness? And yeah, you were saying that like in terms of like all these sort of players bring with them opportunities and they bring with them sort of cultural powers. And yeah, like what place isn't affected by external powers, right? Like what country hasn't been drawn and redrawn? I mean, even the Arab countries, right? Those came about as a result of British and American like intelligence and French intelligence, like boosting their rebellion. So like they were indirectly midwifed, like the way that Mujahideen was midwifed by these Western powers again. And so this constant dance between Afghans and outside powers meddling in their country. I mean, meddling is such like an easy word. It's like, and it doesn't do justice to like what has happened for centuries now. I mean, it doesn't really, like meddling is like something specific, but you just think in terms of millions of people, millions of Afghans, just like their fates in the hands of all these power, like a handful of these powers, powerful men who change hands and the class and stuff. I mean, maybe if we have time, we can talk about that. The figure you, Elphinstone. I was reading a little bit about him, like what a character. That itself is like, because those are like these minor figures, like you don't hear about guys like him. And I studied, you know, 19th century Victorian stuff. You hear the big names, right? Like you hear a lot of different big names, and they're usually in India. They're usually maybe whatever Cromer and stuff, but like, you know, like you don't hear the guy, like you didn't I definitely never heard of anything like him. But where was I going with this? But anyways, that wasn't even a question. But yeah, it's this stuff is really mind-boggling. I mean, one thing I did have to say is that this question of Pashto, right? Because Pashto is Pashto the closest thing to kind of unifying the country, like linguistically, or is that Dari?
Oh no, Persian is the glue.
Persian is the glue, so it has that
holds that linguistically. I mean, there is just absolutely no doubt that Afghanistan, as you know, we understand it, is historically, you know, a Persianate environment where Persian is, and we have to kind of remember in this context that there's a lot of languages circulating and in play here, and they have different kinds of expression. Some are written, some are spoken, some are spoken in very narrow valleys, some are more widely spoken. And Persian assumes a kind of classical form, as Latin might appear in relation to something like a vernacular, such as English or German or something like that. Pashto is a language that it's an Iranian language family, as these genealogies of language relations are drawn, but it is a vernacular subordinated to the power of Persian. Pashto really, like many other languages, sort of take shape in some ways, many important ways, through Persian. The writing system, for example, is modified from Persian, which is itself modified Arabic script. So what might have led to your question is this sense that Afghanistan has a bilingual kind of there's Pashto and there's Persian, but we have to remember that those languages don't relate to one another equally by any stretch of the imagination. Pashto has historically been kind of fighting for textual and political space in Afghanistan. It appears episodically and sporadically, whereas Persian is sort of always ever present there. It's just more than the cultural elephant in the room. It is the room. So
maybe related to that though, is that maybe you can give us a sense of the part of why I said, like, the part of the sort of fictitiousness of a lot of the countries in the entire region is that they hold, we think of the way we live in Western, like where we live and our part of the world and the kind of cultural sphere, is that you have these white settler societies that are dominated by this history of sort of white supremacist racism that's like mapped on top of an indigenous, like a genocide of indigenous people, and then filtered through migration and of various like European and then non-European, you know, whatever, right? Peoples and groups and languages. So like, that's the kind of way we tend to sort of think of countries. But like, part of the regional calculus is that there are many different ethnicities, and Afghanistan is obviously no exception. So maybe we can get a sense of the diversity. I mean, that's a terrible word. It's been ruined by so many like technocrats, but like, it is a good thing to have like a diverse country. It makes you stronger, and it makes your like your own cultural heritage and the interchange between, I guess, the major language or major dominant cultures and the so-called minor ones. It makes it more interesting. And anyway, so like, this is a facet of the region and not just Afghanistan, but maybe we can kind of get a sense, give us a sense of where peoples are and the language and the distribution of the languages, because a lot of it is also, is just kind of alien to people.
Sure. Well, you know, I would say in terms of a linguistic profile, let's remember that, you know, Islam and Persian have strong urban, you know, profile that, you know, we find a lot of literate elites and, you know, state infrastructure, bureaucratically, its architecture in cities. And so maybe we can think of Persian speaking cities and perhaps the rural zone, of which there are many different kind of ecological zones in the rural zone. And the most complicating thing here are the mountainous highlands of the Hindu Kush, where there's tremendous linguistic diversity. And in broad measure, we can, and this will be contestable for sure, but we can say that if we find Persian, not just in the city, but then in between the cities in the rural zone as the language that you need to know to interact with the urban markets and the urban bureaucracies and the state. So Persian is kind of always there, is the point I want to make, as a cloud, even though it's concentrated in cities, so to speak. North of the Hindu Kush, we get Turkic languages, and Uzbek would be a most demographically prominent Turkic language. But there are so many smaller Turkic dialects spoken in the north, and I've interviewed Afghans that speak a language they can't describe. They don't know the name of it, but it sounds with some Turkish elements. To me, to my ear, which is not, you know, it's not trained in the local environment. I was born and raised in the United States. So, but the point here is that to the south of the Hindu Kush, we find Pashto and other related languages like Baluchi. And that broad distinction with Turkic languages north of the Hindu Kush, Pashto and other languages to the south, perhaps Indic and Iranian language to the south, that leaves the Hindu Kush spine itself, particularly the Alpine highlands, the glacial Alpine highlands of eastern Afghanistan, known historically as Kafiristan, land of the Kafirs, that becomes Nuristan, land of light, when it's forcibly Islamized in the 19th century. But that region is where there is incredible linguistic diversity. This is the area where you find really truly distinct languages and valleys and a number of other, you know, kind of dozen to scores of languages in these Hindu Kush and Himalayan highlands. Broadly, I would say that's kind of the linguistic profile, perhaps.
And there's also the majority of the country is Hanafi, right? Hanafi Sunni?
Well, first of all, you know, in terms of numbers and demography and statistics, let's just get one thing clear. Nobody really knows. All of the numbers that are given about the population and the distribution, that's largely invented. There may be some quantitative basis, but it's still very approximate, very approximate. And that the ambiguousness is important here. But No, there is a very, very historically prominent role for Shia Muslims, particularly Qizilbash Shia Muslims, in Afghan political history, in Afghan urban and commercial and bureaucratic history. The Qizilbash have been at the center, really, of Kabul politics during the Afghan state era. The Hazara community of central Afghanistan, where the Bamiyan Buddhas once stood, another Shia group. There are a number of other Shia communities there. And what's important here is that there's some kind of a bridge historically between Shiism and Sunnism, Tasawwuf and Hanafi versions of Islam, let's say. And that's Tasawwuf, that Tashayo, Shiism, and Tasawwuf, Sufism, is what I'm referencing here. Afghanistan historically is a kind of eclectic Islamic environment where Sufi sort of local folk traditions and shrine cultures prevail. Violently orthodox moment, perhaps we can see here somehow historically as episodic. That's not the general cultural rule for the landscape. Bigotry doesn't win really well in Afghanistan. It's a tolerant, historically very diverse and tolerant environment. And it's really, I think, Sina, the inherent diversity culturally and geographically of this region gets noticed, understood in some ways by imperial powers, the British and the Americans in particular, and they identify with particular groups. And it's the invention of the idea of closed ethnic categories where these Pashtuns are supposed to hate these people because that's what the British thought that the world looked like in everywhere. The British saw sort of tribes competing against one another and religions, and the Americans in modern science sees ethnicity.
If they projected their own violence, sectarian history, both inside the country of England, on the British Isles as well, and also basically most of Europe. Like the way that they project that onto our region is so where, which is mostly like in throughout its vast history of all these different generations for a long time, like millennia, has been relatively peaceful in terms, like has been fairly like nothing compared to the violence of Europe. I mean, they did the genocide, they did the Holocaust in Europe. Right. Like that, like the racist, that was like this orgy of racist violence and the way that that gets projected onto Afghans. I mean, I guess now this is probably what we should get into, which is the rise of the Taliban, because this, unfortunately, the face of the Taliban, the sort of stern authority, like the heavy handed brutality of like in the name of like Puritan Islam. Right. Like this is unfortunately the prevailing image of Afghanistan now, which, you know, so maybe it's time to kind of understand their rise. And obviously we can begin with Mujahideen, but, you know better than me.
Sure. Well, you know, what was your word that you made a verb out of midwife? Was it midwifery? Midwifery of the Taliban really kind of out of the Mujahideen, which are themselves a CIA supported and ISI supported group of Afghans that were seen through the lens of ethnicity, with the Tajiks over here and the Pashtuns over here kind of thing, Hazara over here. And that is, again, large scale sort of violence to the, which rises probably to war crimes in some form, that the Talibs emerge out of, kind of trying to prevent the orgy of violence in Kabul after, Najibullah stepped down, involved all kinds of very grievous, crimes against humanity, Afghan on Afghan, really horrific human on human gendered violence of very, very, just the ugliness of humanity. The emergence of the Taliban against that lawless, kind of bandit environment of the Mujahideen Of course, didn't last that long, and until which the point here is that the Taliban had certainly local roots. If we want to think of Kandahar as a center and Pashtuns and the Pashto language being an important part of the Taliban identity, I think that's totally fair. But it's, you know, another way of looking at this is that historically Kandahar has never really, shall we say, gotten along well with Kabul. There's been a lot of tension between these two cities historically, back in the Mughal and Safavid early modern centuries. Those two cities were alternating back and forth between two imperial powers, and their unity is somehow very, very tenuous and strenuous. And the Taliban represent in some way that, in that way, sort of the resurgence of Kandahar against the excesses of Kabul. And there's a lot more going on than you know region here. There are clearly the regionalization of the Afghan war, the role of Pakistan, which is there must be multiple midwives of the Mujahideen with the United States and the ISI, the CIA and the ISI are the two midwives, I guess, but Pakistan stays very tightly involved with the Taliban, really throughout the period of their first rule. Largely brutal and illegal, you know, execution of Najibullah is apparently carried out by Urdu-speaking Pakistanis. And so the sort of role of Pakistanis and the current resurgence of the Taliban has also been noted in, you know, various forums. So, but of course, Pakistan is not disconnected from its, you know, I guess, imperial patron in the United States is that. So,
I mean, I'm asking you to read Pakistani minds here, but like, is the decision to back the Taliban, like, I mean, in itself, not remarkable? And, you know, everybody picks a proxy, right? Especially in like, you know, 80s, 90s, Afghanistan, those 15 years, like before the Taliban took over, like, you know, that and the war and the occupation and stuff. Like that, a bunch of different sort of outside factions picked their people, right? And the fact that Pakistan picked Taliban, was this like a matter of just like they picked the dark horse candidate that went wild above their dreams that they ever imagined, that it could now not just beat the Afghan state, but also survive the American occupation? Because we're 30 years into, I mean, some of these Talibs, I mean, I imagine not many of them exist anymore because we're talking 45 years now. But some of these Talibs, like senior ones, were around for 79, right? Like they came, like some of them must have been. I don't know what percentage, but like those are dudes who have been at it for 30 years. Like they've been fighting for 30 years, 35.
You know, two things with your comments. You know, one is I think we need to be very, very hesitant to look at either the state actors like Pakistan and the United States or the local actors like the Taliban as single unified groups. States have covert and overt policies. The ambassador of the United States says one thing, the CIA is doing something else. There are multiple different, the Taliban have a different leadership structure. It's sort of a collective, you know, in principle, structurally a collective leadership, not individualized. Pakistani sort of individual operators have certain contacts. Everyone has a kind of local contact. And so the other point here is I think this goes a bit deeper because Pakistan, remember, arises really only in 1947. And immediately the United States, you know, recognizes Pakistan, and Pakistan is, you know, it's vulnerable. And the Indian partition was its own, you know, really kind of genocidal levels of violence with India's partition. Pakistan is strangely configured with these two wings, East and West Pakistan. And Afghanistan doesn't Well, at least in the UN, I think Afghanistan was the only state that voted against Pakistan's admission to the United Nations. The Afghan state then immediately in the late 40s and 50s begins advocating for a state called Pashtunistan that would detach the Pashto speakers in Pakistan, or at least allow them a plebiscite to vote for their own polity called Pashtunistan that would further carve Pakistan. And the Pashtunistan issue caused great tension between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it was used in a way to lure international actors, the Soviets and the Americans, you know, kind of the Americans not sympathetic to the Afghan Pashtunistan sort of trial balloon floatings of that idea. The Soviets more kind of amenable to the idea. In a way, and we'd have to be really, again, careful to say that this Taliban, you know, it's sort of the revenge of Pashtunistan.
I had no idea about that. That's wild. They tried to do a regime change war on Pakistan, and now it's come back to haunt them.
It wasn't quite as regime change as much as just further trying to delegitimize an unstable, fledgling polity.
And they had the East Pakistan problem too. I mean, I guess that's a little later though. East Pakistan breaking away into Bangladesh, right? Like it's a volatile mix in that time. Yeah.
71. And we've missed India in all this. And like India's, its relationship to Pakistan and the role of Kashmir here, you know, in this war of the, you know, 80s and 90s, Kashmir is such a central part of all of this. Afghan Mujahideen would go to Kashmir for training. And that, Indo-Pakistan conflict over Kashmir did affect the course of the development of the Mujahideen in the Afghan war and the rise of the Taliban. It's absolutely critical here. We've missed maybe again the context of the Iranian Revolution, which just transforms the geopolitics of Islamic Islamic geopolitics in dramatic ways. Afghanistan is not immune from that at all.
1979 was a wild year, man. Wild, because it's also you have the invasion, Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, right? You have the Iranian Revolution, and you also have like the siege of Mecca. Didn't that happen in 79? I think that's also 79. I'm not sure actually.
Yeah, I think it is. I think you're right, or 80.
Yeah.
I think such an interesting thing I'm starting to realize is that part of this kind of imperial game is always sort of backing one person, but being in touch informally with his allies and trying to be ready to play musical chairs with the next, you know, kind of client who can advance your interests. It's really, in that sense, a game of I don't want to say musical chairs, but there's something to the interaction between empires and between imperial formal and informal expressions of empire, covert, overt activities.
I mean, they themselves call it the great game. So, I mean, it gives it away right there.
Yeah.
One of the things that's also interesting about like sort of, I mean, we're now, I mean, we haven't gotten to the invasion of Afghanistan because we haven't gotten to 9/11. To think of like the second half of the 90s and what the Taliban manages to do, like as a state actor, right? Or it's like establishing its own brand of a state, right? Like kind of molding its reactionary sort of politics to a state formation. And that takes like in that sort of 5-year period, like 96 or something, right? Like, or whatever, to 2001, that they don't even rule over the entirety of the country at that point, right? Like they don't even, like there's the stuff they still don't even achieve sovereignty fully over the country the way that they're doing now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think let's also remember that historically, there is not really any entity that has exerted uniform, thorough control over the whole space called Afghanistan. It just has never happened. And so, you know, there's sort of loose sovereignties that maybe best captures this. But at the same time, you know, when we think today that the Taliban sort of control all aspects of Afghanistan, and the point I'm trying to make, I think, is that the profile of the Afghan state, no matter who's operating it, is on the one hand, you know, very tangible and sort of in that sense visible, strong in certain ways, but also really not very effective or invisible in other ways, particularly in the rural zone, where there's rural spaces in Afghanistan that just have really nothing to do with Kabul. And if anything, what they're organizing is to keep Kabul at a distance.
And this is what they sort of call tribal areas in Orientalist tongue.
Possibly. I think the problem with that framing, the Orientalist framing, is that tribes are separate, distinct, hermetically sealed entities from one another. But that's, that's obviously Orientalist and not accurate, because what tribalism really is, like Afghanistan itself, is really a fluid, diverse, cosmopolitan thing. Tribes want to integrate with other tribes because of the value of political contacts with the outside world. Tribalism is a formation with a lot of externalities involved in it, and local Afghan tribalism, so to speak, is, I think, a bit more certainly diverse and heterogeneous than the colonial tribal view of the world within these discrete little entities.
I mean, it's interesting you say that, because the national question, right, is not as pressing, right? Like, Italy doesn't exist before the late 19th century, the country of Italy, right? Like, they had to make themselves Italian. Like, and there are parts of Italy today that are still not really Italian. It's called Sicily. And they don't really, like, you know what I mean? And that's like 200 years later. So like to think that in terms of like, oh, these like tribal areas where these people, whatever, but it's like, it's interesting to think that like after so many imperial misadventures, after centuries, that like the resistance to being incorporated into a state is a kind of, I don't know, I want to say, I mean, I apologize for the biopolitical terms, but it's a kind of like immune response of like, we don't trust outsiders. Look what outsiders have done to us. We're going to keep our political formations of our areas to ourselves, our food production, all that stuff. And that could be one of the reasons why, like, again, as you mentioned earlier, like the population estimates, the sectarian estimates are all wrong in the case of Afghanistan. Like, God knows who lives where and who does what, right? Like, it's not like, I mean, they had to do a whole fake polio campaign to find bin Laden in Pakistan. Yeah. Like, they didn't know where he was, because it's like, those are parts of the country that like resist. I mean, I don't want to sound too Foucauldian in this one, but like, do they resist surveillance for a good reason?
Absolutely. Yeah. Who wants to be, once you're taxed, you become legible. You start giving conscripted, members of your community, then, you're tied. No one, autonomy is, maybe a universal human value or something that states are not really into, states want to control things. So, yeah, you mentioned bin Laden. We
should probably talk about 9/11, huh?
I was going to say, there's so much that we've left out, But anyway, yeah, I'm happy to, if it's moving to the present that you'd like to do, I'm happy to follow you.
Yeah, we should probably get into that, because we are about to be inundated with some major trauma porn, man. We are going to get, there is going to be a lot of like, corny segments on broadcast news TV, a lot of like weeping widows. I'm sorry to be so cynical, but I don't know, after doing this job for like 3 years, I just watch these things happen with like every supposed anniversary, and I can sense it coming. I have, in fact, I have, in fact, planned a camping trip for 9/11 so that I am not around and I don't have to be online.
That'll be quite an interesting ritual.
Because that's the end of the Taliban, right? Like, because that really, when we say 9/11, we say the end of Taliban, I guess, 1.0, because they don't last that after the American bombing, right? Like, they say that.
Yeah, well, I guess that word, you know, if I could just use it as the, you know, the real anchor for 9/11. I mean, since literally October 8th, 2001, it's been just incessant, violent imperial punishment, incessant bombing, really just a rain of absolute drone terror, B-52 terror, every kind of flying death vehicle imaginable. Military experimentation in the, you know, black sites and illegal renditions, kind of pain rays and surveillance, digital surveillance. I mean, it's just been
the biometric data collection around Afghans and Iraqis. I mean, the 20 years they've had to, like, as you put it, experiment militarily. And in that time too, military air power transformed. Like Afghans had to undergo a stitching point, let's say, in military history, in global military history, in fact. Right. Like, that's the Afghans felt that first.
Oh, and it is the it's the legacy, and this is it just is ultimately. And the point here is the censorship and propaganda. This is the, you know, high tech age. It's the birth of computers around, you know, 2001. It's, you know, it's the smart war and this nonsense of smart bombs, you know, perfectly going down drain, you know, chimney pipes and only killing terrorists, and the sort of GIS war, big data, I think it's the GIS technology, and, you know, that's seductive. As I was saying, empires have this, kind of overconfidence, and the overconfidence in these technologies, the aerial killing and global mapping technologies, really gave a false sense of progress. But it's really just the censorship and propaganda. I mean, we can be a little more harsh and say just all kinds of lies about bin Laden. This bin Laden, whether the polio stuff has been, I guess, validated, but the lie that they've, you know, taken Osama bin Laden's body, ran immediately to the Indian Ocean and gave a Muslim burial at sea, which there's no such thing. That's just a lie. I mean, and the lie of the Iraq war, the lie of voting and democracy, you know, it's a real problem for the democratic functioning of any democratic functioning, that sort of securitization of data. Can't talk about it. Can't talk about anything. There's no reporting. The limited reporting in Iraq dwarfs over 20 years the reporting from Afghanistan.
The fact that how much they erased the Iraq war from the cultural discourse, erased Afghanistan even more.
It's exponential difference, actually. And we see really tangible, I mean, you see things in Iraq, like the human birth defects from depleted uranium, the radiation of Fallujah, I mean, has been documented by journalists and just gruesome photos. Afghanistan, we don't have that documentation, but we hear of birth defects among humans and animals in Afghanistan, Eastern Afghanistan, beginning with Tora Bora, bombing the mountain range for bin Laden, leaving a toxicity the toxins from these military bases. Bagram, like all military bases around the world, are just full of forever chemicals and depleted uranium. And these provincial reconstruction team bases all throughout the country. The pollution of Kabul, the destruction of the environment, the military destruction, the environmental consequences of this bombardment are the absolute largest crime against humanity. I mean, retribution for this is it's unquantifiable to render a place uninhabitable.
Retribution for an act committed by Saudis on the whole.
Yeah, the poor innocent Afghan people. And what is most important here is that we as Afghans have been really kind of systematically deprived of a realistic critical understanding of ourselves. The people who have been writing about Afghan history from so-called Afghan perspectives are actually parroting kind of colonial ways of understanding self. It's called crypto-colonialism in the literature. And Afghanistan is the sort of epitome of a crypto colony, apparently never formally colonized, but fully absorbed with colonial frames of reference to the world and to the self. So, and the profiteering of this post 9/11 era, the complete outsourcing of these things, the contractors, another legal gray zone, where the American military apparently has rules of conduct, but these contractors really don't. And the contractors are going to stay forever anyway. There's no withdrawal. There'll be contractors there and, covert operations there kind of perpetually, just like the rest of the world, where in maintaining this over the horizon capability means drone wars and sort of bombardment from the air are going to continue there. And they say as much here. And, for the American audience, again, just the expense of this has really left such a tenuous amount of debt. You can't catch up and invest in education and infrastructure when you're just the executive authority, the concentration of covert operations power in the executive, that shields it from Congress. And so the president or whoever it is authorizes these covert operations and special operations that are the most insidious forms of imperial activity. This is truly the abductions and tortures of, I think what went on in Bagram, let me tell you, would make Abu Ghraib of course not look light or a picnic or anything, but I just can't even imagine the horrors in Bagram and what went on there for 20 years.
So I mean, it's like the difficult thing for talk about is that I know in my heart that the brutality, the unfathomable brutality of the Taliban, especially in those early years, it pales in comparison to what the Americans did to that country, to what the world did to that country. To people, and the ratio of the ratio of disgust and outpouring of grief, yeah, over the violence of the Taliban versus the relative silence of 20 years of American bombings and brutality. I mean, they're occupying a chunk of Cuba where they have one of their illegal prisons where they ship over Afghans to huge parts, a number of black sites all over the world. I mean, the people who planned the first phase of the Afghan war were the guy like Cheney and stuff. They had this crazy passenger service of kidnappees. I mean, talk about a hostage crisis. I wonder how it must feel for you in terms of to watch their hasty exit, because on the one hand, you have to be relieved that thank God that they're out. But what's the other feeling? Is there another feeling? What are your raw sentiments? Yeah.
Well, I guess, looking at just the projections from the media and the sort of the veterans in tears over their moral obligation to their translators. And during the 20 years, they hated their translators, and the translators hated them. There might be one nice friendship relationship that develops in truth, but they didn't trust each other. The empires and their translators, they never trust each other. And so this is sort of feigned love, and it's late for, you know, moral, you know, obligations after what you've done. It's accountability, not obligations, that I'm interested in. And I do appreciate that there's all kinds of inequities and power hierarchies, and gendered are prominent, and the experience of women under the Taliban compared to the American, period is, stark, but it's also, it's not as clean as that, because all of these, I just saw, for example, that the Afghan girls' soccer team has somehow escaped en masse to a safe location somewhere. But the creation of the Afghan girls' soccer team involves sexual abuse, kind of office harassment of the most violent sort by their coach, a man who is under, you know, sanction from UEFA for, you know, kind of, again, sexual, kind of crimes against women. And the role, the amount of, you know, the Me Too movement has brought the inequities of the office space and working relationships to bear. But, if you listen to women, their experience at Kabul University is full of a lot of the sort of modern sexualized violence that we hear about, in spaces, in sort of celebrity cases today. And so it's just not as clean and simple as pro or anti woman. In theory, it seems to me that the Americans would like to extract all of the Afghan women and just take them someplace. What do you want to do with them? What do you want to make of them?
This is like a classic feature of Orientalism too, is that, white women saving brown women from brown men. And like, this is this recurring thing. I mean, we had to, if we, like 20 years ago, we were subjected to, remember that, like somebody in Congress, like read something out, like put on like a burqa, like, and like read something out like that, the level of performance around the like supposed concern for Afghan women, like, I mean, it was off the charts in terms of pathology. Yeah. Because meanwhile, they're just ramping up a war to kill people. Lots of women, too.
Let's also be clear about empires and wars and prostitution and the trafficking of women, the trafficking of Central Asian women, of Russian women, Philippine, Thai, and Afghan women. There now are whorehouses in Afghanistan servicing these people. The trafficking of women, the treatment, the illegal, I mean, the it's just criminal to claim the moral high ground for women after. And again, the way this was routed was that the Americans are there to bomb ruthlessly Pashto-speaking men in the hinterlands, in the rural zone, to save Afghan women in the urban, Persian-speaking women in the urban zone. It just absurdities, really. I have a real appreciation for the gendered nation and the emotions of the genderedness, but this is a very, a much more kind of a gray zone rather than a black and white layer of consideration, really. And I at the same time really do appreciate that all states and all forms of power have gross inequities that are readily available, and the gender dimension of kind of Talib rule is not just inherently positive either. I'm well aware of that, but you know, part of the censorship and propaganda is shading the truth and sort of bending the data to fit the politics, and that's just not the way it's experienced on the ground,
So it's been a while. I've kept you for almost an hour and a half. So I'm gonna release you from your duties. Thank you for the time. Thank you. But maybe as part of a closing point, you can kind of we can think about like what one scenario of rebuilding Afghanistan that's been floated, and obviously it's a regional thing. It's not just unique to Afghanistan. People are saying this about Syria as well, yeah. Is this new power actor, relatively new, right? Like definitely been around for a long time, but obviously like China has a deep investment in the region and in terms of BRI, like this is a question I'm asking a lot of people these days. Could Afghanistan find, I mean, the joke word I want to use, and this is a big ironic like quotes around it, a salvation in the Chinese in terms of an outside power that is intent, that isn't going to bomb them? Like it doesn't, I don't know. I mean, I can't see the future, but it's just not, I don't see that happening. But like, you know, it's rare for an outside country to come in and build things in Afghanistan that isn't exactly, I mean, I guess it happened under the Soviets, but like, yeah. And the Americans did it too, but obviously for their own imperial benefit. But like, mm-hmm. Does the trade that China's BRI offers, right, the global access to trade, could that be at least part of an answer to the incredible injustice visited upon Afghanistan, Afghan people for centuries now?
If that implies some kind of, you know, non-militarized economic, you know, development's a coded word, you know, progress is also difficult, but, you know, improvement in the material conditions of ordinary people, I think it's possible. China's not, you know, projecting its power around the world through, you know, military bases and black sites, and that, you know, kind of, I guess, in principle bodes well. But at the same time, you know, China is a ruthless environmental polluter and developer, and its copper mine in Masai Naik, you may be aware of, a huge multi-billion-dollar contract for copper mining just south of Kabul. I think could be followed by a lot of large-scale mining of lithium in particular in the north. And I don't know what particular policies are in play, at least kind of diplomatically or strategically between the two. But yes, I think it's reasonable to see China playing an increased role. But we have to remember this through the lens of Pakistan, because Pakistan and China have a close relationship and have had really through the Karakoram exchange route, and that you know, one major power brings in a lot of subsidiary and secondary alliances into play. So the China-Iran relationship is also important here strategically. The kind of proximity strategically between Iran and China also may kind of figure into that prospect that you described. And it might be salvation. For me, salvation is water. We need to be able to have water for ourselves. We need to be able to feed ourselves first as Afghans. And we can't, you know, our water supply is in great jeopardy. Kabul is running out of water, by the way. Everyone knows it. And the water supply, and again, the sort of water wars, so to speak, between Iran and Afghanistan over the Helmand and sort of Hanun swamplands or lake are really important here. So I'm interested in preserving a sort of a sustainability environmentally, particularly with a strong agricultural base. It's an agricultural setting. We need to be able to use our agriculture to feed ourselves and not produce things like opium for a world market. And those are the things I'm concerned about. The political artifice around sort of the I want security and at the daily local level. And then I think politics should be, in the end, what I'm hoping for is some kind of, I don't want to say strictly Afghan solution, because there's no such thing as a strictly Afghan solution, because no one really agrees even what an Afghan is, kind of, and I mean that very seriously. That word is quite contentious now. So I think the more likely prospect, and again, we have to think about the artificiality of all nation states, so to speak, and the world, and Afghan ourselves. We came from historically a space or place that was not Afghanistan in the time of the empires we began discussing today. And I think it's feasible to see Afghanistan sort of not fragmenting per se, but kind of being reconfigured, so to speak, in some way that may leave the entity Afghanistan off the map, so to speak. And that's not at all a happy prospect for Afghans, but I think it's the future. We can't avoid the possibility of that. So,
Professor Hanifi, I've kept you for over 90 minutes. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this. This is really illuminating. We talked a lot. We covered a lot of ground, man. That was pretty cool. So would you tell us something that you're working on? What can we look forward to reading from you? What's something you just put out?
Sure. Well, I'm really happy for the opportunity. This was a really enjoyable conversation for me. So thank you for reaching out. And I think what I'd like to kind of bill myself as right now is an environmental historian. I'm trying to write a book that has four major chapters in it, involving the history of forests, the history of water, the history of food, and the history of animals in Afghanistan. So what you can look for in the near term is an article called The Deep History of Water in Afghanistan, where I'm just looking at, again, the kind of aquatic history of a landlocked nation, so to speak, through its rivers and aquifers. So I can't promise anything soon, but that's what's on my mind these days. So thanks for asking, Sina, and thanks again for the opportunity to join you today.
Thank you, Professor Hanifi. Appreciate it.
All right. Take good care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.